Welcome to Foresight Friday Roundup, Foresight Health's podcast series for healthcare revolutionaries. Outcomes matter, customers count, and value rules. Hello again, everyone. This is Dave Berta, news editor at Foresight Health. It is Friday, April 29th. It'll be May next week. Had that happen. And I've got my first spring cold, as you can hear. In today's episode of the Roundup, we are going to talk about how the COVID-19 pandemic, yes, we're still experiencing a public health emergency, has affected physician behavior. Specifically, we're going to talk about trends in physician employment, thanks to a new report from the Physicians Advocacy Institute, and trends in physicians' use of telemedicine, thanks to a recent report from the American Medical Association. To tell us how these trends are reshaping the practice of medicine, are Dave Johnson, founder and CEO of Foresight Health, and Julie Murchison, partner at Transformation Capital. Hi, Dave. Hi, Julie. How are you guys doing this morning? Dave?
My niece Kim is in town visiting while my wife Terry is away at a spa in Arizona with her best friend from college. Good for her. Kim is a rising star at Teladoc and was my partner, as you may remember, in writing the lyrics to our February song, Video Rocks Consumer Healthcare. Like me, she was an English major and is a big reader. For example, I've learned a lot about octopus intelligence and behaviors the last couple of days. We're also having fun talking healthcare, taking walks, and cooking together. So I'm doing great.
That's great. I'm convinced octopi are aliens. So let me know if she's got a theory on that.
Well, she corrected me on the plural of octopus. It's octopuses, not octopi.
Oh, really? Okay.
There you go.
Like we say, we always learn something new on the Roundup. Julie, how are you?
I am good. I have a rash of friends who are now finally getting COVID. I feel like the rest of the world who hasn't had it, have it. And I'm getting my second booster tonight. So I'm super excited.
Oh, good for you. Yeah, I'm hoping this is a cold or allergies, and we'll see what happens. Good luck.
Yeah.
Now, before we talk about physician employment and telemedicine, let's talk about Twitter. Twitter was a Twitter this week after Elon Musk agreed to buy the social media platform for $44 billion. Dave, if the deal closes, will you change your Twitter habits?
Twitter me this, Elon. It will be interesting to see what Mr. Musk does with Twitter and whether he can turn me into a Twitter user. I'm not one now. But maybe he'll be able to make me a social media maven like you, Dave. I can only hope.
We all have aspirations. Thanks, Dave. Julie, how about you? Any change in your Twitter use because of Elon Musk?
I can't say I think a lot about it. It's not the mainstay in my life. But I just want to point out the craziness around him that might pull other people into other things he wants to buy. He tweeted about something last night that said, next I'm buying Coca-Cola to put the cocaine back in. So maybe Coca-Cola will get a new rise. Who knows?
Now you know why I'm not a Twitter user, you know?
Exactly.
That's great. Thanks, Julie. I guess as long as people I know and trust keep using it to share healthcare news, I'll stay on it. And I always think it's good to know what all the crazies are doing so you could respond accordingly. And maybe in this case, it's not by Coke anymore. Speaking of responding accordingly, that's what doctors appeared to do because of the pandemic. Let's talk about this new report on physician employment from the Physicians Advocacy Institute. It said 108,700 doctors left independent practice from 2019 through 2021 to become employees of hospitals, health systems, or other corporate entities. Of that total, 83,000 or 76% left in 2020 and 2021, or after the pandemic started. And by the end of 2021, 74% of all doctors were employed by hospitals, health systems, or other corporate entities. The Institute attributed the acceleration in physician employment to COVID-19, saying the pressures of the pandemic forced many independent physicians to make difficult decisions to sell their practices. Dave, what's your reaction to the numbers? Do you blame the pandemic or something else going on? And how will all this ultimately affect consumers?
Before responding to your questions, Dave, I want to raise an issue regarding the underlying data set used in the analysis. The Federation of State Medical Boards lists just over a million practicing physicians in the U.S. in 2020. That's up 20% from 2010. Avalara used the IQVIA One Key data set, which includes roughly 650,000 licensed physicians. So what happened to the other 350,000? You know, it's not a trivial question. But applying the law of compensating error, let's assume the study's findings are directionally accurate, which I believe they are. So let's tackle your three questions. First, the study's numbers don't surprise me, like the disappearance of family farms, the dwindling of independent physician practices has been going on for a long time, and it will continue. More interesting is the accelerating growth of physician groups owned by hospitals and corporate entities. That percentage jumped by 38% during the three-year study period versus just 19% for physician practices overall. So a substantial majority of the shift to external ownership occurred when independent physician groups sold to new owners. To your second question, there was a slight uptick in employed physicians during the pandemic. COVID-related sales may have had an impact at the margins, but the real drivers are economic. The increasing administrative burden and costs of operating independent practices and groups is a key factor, combined with very, very attractive purchase prices. A lot of money flowing around out there. And then finally, regarding how increasing physician employment affects consumers, near term, I think it's a mixed bag. Larger organizations can adapt to new technologies more quickly, so administrative tasks like scheduling appointments, receiving lab tests, results, and paying bills should be easier. Larger organizations may bring some efficiency, but they also bring higher prices. Most anticipated returns from acquiring these practices come from negotiating higher payment rates from commercial insurers, increasing referrals to hospitals when hospitals acquire, increasing use of ancillary services, and increased markups on implants and supplies. Longer term, however, I think the picture is better as the market demands ever greater value from providers. Larger and more proficient organizations will be better positioned to deliver superior outcomes at lower costs with better customer service. That's great for consumers, right?
Yeah, we'll see which way it goes. High prices or better service? Thanks, Dave. Julie, any comments or questions for Dave?
Okay, Dave, here's a good one. The Physicians Advocacy Institute says that it's important to preserve the physician-patient relationship and maintain physicians' clinical autonomy. I have words for this sentence. I won't share them here. They're not family-friendly, but do you agree with this statement?
Hypocrisy is the tribute vice pays to virtue. This is a tricky question, Julie, and thank you for putting me on the hot seat with it. Nobody likes to be told what to do. Daniel Pink, in his book Drive, identified autonomy, mastery, and purpose as the three key motivators for professionals. So autonomy is important. Relationships are also important. People who believe they're going to get better often do. Supportive physicians that empathize and encourage patients are vital to the healing process. At the same time, and this is a big, big, big however, we can't separate autonomy from outcomes. I wouldn't drive a car without seatbelts because some engineer believes we should all be safer drivers. Far too often, physicians' clinical autonomy, sometimes called physician preference, leads to suboptimal care delivery. They simply choose to practice as they see fit rather than what drives the best outcomes. So as in all professions, we should encourage autonomy in medicine if it drives better outcomes, regardless of whether or not the practice is owned independently by a hospital or a corporate entity.
Got it, Dave. Let's hope so. Thank you. Now let's talk about this recent report from the AMA. The AMA surveyed about 2,300 physicians in November and December and asked them about their use of telemedicine. Here are some of the top line survey results, which the AMA released last month. 85% said they're using telemedicine. Of those, 93% are doing live interactive video visits with patients. 69% are doing audio only visits. And I think they mean phone calls, right? And 54% said using telemedicine has improved their job satisfaction. Julie, what's your take on these numbers? Do they reflect what you're hearing from the market? And is telemedicine enough to keep independent doctors from selling out to hospitals, health systems, and other corporate entities?
Well, first, just to kind of set the stage for where I'm coming from, I just heard a former policy leader recently say, we may have the highest number of physicians, nurses, and other care workers today than we're ever going to see in the future. So just think about that. And COVID has broken this already, you know, quite broken workforce. And they taught us that we don't have the capacity to care for today's population, let alone our growing population. So I don't know, COVID's helped us put the writing on the wall for all this, right? We need to get creative. We need to figure out how telehealth can be our first step. So I'm thrilled to see these numbers, honestly. I do think they comport with a lot of different things they're seeing. So I'll try to break it down a little bit. Slightly more than half the respondents say they're motivated to increase telehealth use in their practices. And we're seeing two things happen. One is, you know, physicians and therapists are being recruited and joining virtual care models that are serving more specific markets and needs, behavioral health, women, LGBTQ, Medicaid, you know, you name it, going in droves, kidney care, like massive business model shifts here. And they're pulling physicians into those models. Second, we're seeing those physicians who are staying in their kind of original structure pre-COVID develop hybrid models more frequently. And they're starting to do so for reasons beyond just patient convenience or experience. I do think a lot of this is starting to be branded as experience, which I love. But, you know, we're starting to see some businesses realize they need to increase access to consumers and get more of certain types of segments into their practices or health systems. So telehealth becomes a great pull for that. I was intrigued to see, you know, the stats that medical management and chronic care management are among the highest uses of telehealth. I think that goes to show that we're finding comfort with the more routine and likely lower risk activities for how to use telehealth. So that's going to spur business thinking here. And I was intrigued, though, on the other hand, to see that follow-up care and specialty care are both, they both kind of rank third in their categories for how telehealth is being used. And on one hand, this kind of makes sense because those may require kind of more hands-on services. But on the other hand, we spent so much energy on the front end of where telehealth can create opportunity to screen and triage patients, that we now have opportunities for companies like Memora that we work with to really support those ongoing communications and care protocols between specialty visits to advance follow-up care more efficiently in ways that are easy, frankly, and have been unheard of until the past couple of years. So I think there's actually incredible opportunity on the back end that we haven't even tapped. So that's exciting. And there's a lot of talk about health equity. And I recall when Biden was heading into office, Molly Coy and a multifaceted group of experts advocated that they think seriously about this, Dave, what you called phone calls, but audio-only visits to ensure health equity. And think back to fall of 2020 when Biden was elected. We were just seeing the early ripples of health equity at that point, the wave and focus on health equity. And with today's incredibly intense focus, and frankly, I mean, decades of work to be done, I don't know how audio only doesn't get folded into future reimbursement. It's critical to reach all people. And lastly, I do think reimbursement is going to be the biggest issue. I don't know what's going to happen when we get down to the battle of whether all forms of telehealth and telehealth in general stays at parity with regular reimbursement rates. That's where the rubber will hit the road for sure.
Got it. Lots of positive signs in the numbers and lots of opportunities too. Thank you. Dave, any comments or questions for Julie?
Well, that last point about payment parity is certainly top of mind for physicians. One of the things that struck me in the study was that they identified payment concerns as their top three barriers to offering telehealth services. It does make me wonder when and how patients come first, if that's the mindset. But anyway, Julie, my chance to put you on the hot seat, and I'm looking forward to it. Were you surprised that only 8% of the physician respondents indicated that they were using remote patient monitoring technologies? And if so, what does this lack of pickup say about the vulnerability of physicians and physician practices, I guess traditional physician practices, to digital health business models like you were describing that rely so heavily on these types of technologies, particularly for the follow-up care that you were describing?
Yeah. Unfortunately, anytime I see a single-digit number for a technology like that that's been talked about for over a decade, I'm surprised. But I'm not surprised because we've looked at a bunch of these businesses and there are very few, if any, that show, you know, the business model and adoption model or adoption traction that's really made the case for scalability. So it's concerning, honestly. But what I do think it represents, and Dave, I think you were just saying this, is the opportunity to really use it in the right model and what consumers will want to do at the end of the day as it relates to their care. I think we can only go up from here and in a real way. But if your average physician, medical group, IPA doesn't get on board with how to think about doing this the right way, the startup healthcare businesses will. So this will be good ground for competition.
Yeah, they have to keep pace. And speaking of competition, I think we need more, not less competition in the physician market. And if telemedicine and remote patient monitoring can make that market more competitive, I'm all for it. Good stuff as usual today. Now let's briefly talk about other big news that happened this week. Julie, the hits just keep on coming. What else topped your list this week?
Yeah, I can't stop looking at Teladoc's stock price, to be honest with you. They reported earnings this week and their revenue increased 25% year over year, but they took a goodwill impairment charge of $6.6 billion with a B, which largely looks to be due to Livongo sales cycles and also to the cost it takes to acquire consumers these days because there is so much competition now in the telehealth market. So it's tough because the way it's being interpreted on places like Twitter is really that is telehealth real? And I think people are really misunderstanding what Teladoc represents to telehealth and what really drove this issue. But whatever the drivers are, it is one tough reality.
Yeah, it's a little more complicated than the stock price drop, that's for sure. Thanks, Julie. Dave, what's the big healthcare news that caught your attention this week?
Well, you know, sometimes ignorance is bliss. So I asked Kim, my niece was here visiting, what she thought about the Teladoc stock. And she says she just isn't looking at it. So maybe that's the right way to be. And in terms of my big story for the week, I'm still trying to get over the fact that Elon Musk is going to put cocaine back in Coca-Cola. But after I do that, you may have seen that Eli Lilly announced trial success this week for a potential blockbuster obesity drug. Obviously, that would have just a huge market. Remember Fen-Phen from the 90s? So something for us to keep track of as we move forward.
Yeah, I take your niece's approach to my retirement funds. I'm happy.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks, David. Thank you, Julie. That is all the time we have for today. If you'd like to learn more about the topics we discussed on today's show, please visit our website at foresighthealth.com. And if you follow our show on Apple Podcasts or your favorite streaming service, you'll get notified each time a new episode is available. Don't forget to tell a friend about Foresight Friday Roundup. Subscribe now and don't miss another segment of the best 20 minutes in healthcare. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Berta for Foresight Health.